Support for this podcast comes from Smartwater. Want to get a little more from every sip? Smartwater Alkaline doesn't just taste crisp and pure. It's loaded with everything you need to perform at your best, whether you're running marathons or boardroom meetings. Elevate how you hydrate and pick up a Smartwater Alkaline today. To learn more, visit drinksmartwater.com.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to help you plan that unbelievable travel experience. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
This week, the Chinese government's health authorities were saying that the coronavirus outbreak, this disease that we don't really understand and is spreading like wildfire in the country, was at a peak. But then, on Wednesday, it turned out that there was the highest single-day tally of deaths at any point during the outbreak, raising the question, is the Chinese government still lying about coronavirus? And more broadly, what does it mean that the Chinese government has mishandled the situation so badly for the future of politics in China? That's what we're going to talk about today on Worldly, part of the Vox Media Podcast Network. I'm here with Alex Ward. Jen Williams is out. She's sick, but we don't think it's coronavirus.
We hope it's not coronavirus.
It would be very bad if it was coronavirus.
We share a studio with Jen, and we sit near her.
Okay. We should not scaremonger. Jen does not have coronavirus as far as we know. It's probably just the flu. In fact, if you know anyone who's sick in the U.S., it is probably just the flu.
That's what the statistics would bear out, yes.
Right.
Or just a regular cold. Maybe you just have the sniffles. It'll be fine.
I've just heard people panicking about this inside the United States. As opposed to in China, which is where the outbreak started, where the fears of the spread of coronavirus are very, very real. Like, really, this is a terrifying situation. So as I understand it, we should probably start with what the outbreak is, what a coronavirus actually is, because it's a species of virus, right? This is a specific subset of the broader coronavirus type.
Yeah, so if you remember SARS, right, so it kind of attacks your immune system, of course. It causes seeming like flu-like symptoms. It's arguably the worst cold you could ever have. It does horrible things to your insides that I don't want to go into on the podcast. But safe to say, if you remember SARS, it's kind of like that. And it's part of that family. It seems to be infecting tons of people. Let me just go through some very quick numbers. We don't typically do numbers on the show, but I think it's important. So on Wednesday, we saw 242 people die in Hubei province in China. That's where the center of the outbreak has been. And that was the highest daily death tally since Monday, when there were 103 recorded. So that's a big spike, right? So now we're worried about that this may be accelerating. And what we've seen so far is at least 1,350 people have died from the virus, mostly in Hubei. So it's a problem, right? This has now surpassed the SARS death total. Importantly, it is mostly concentrated in one area. So again, if you're listening to this in the United States or elsewhere outside of China, chances are you're not in trouble. If you're in China, still the chances are you're not in trouble, but that it is the epicenter. And it looks like, and we'll get into this more, but it does look like it's getting a bit out of control.
So in Hubei, the city of Wuhan has been seen as the epicenter of the outbreak. And we're not exactly sure when it started, which is part of the problem, right? Like, according to some experts, the disease may have started spreading to humans and rapidly around October. But that's sort of a guess. We don't know. It's just based on their best estimates. And so the Chinese government has known about this for quite some time, right, even though it only started to make the news in the U.S. in 2020. The part of the reason why nobody knew about it is because the Chinese government hushed up people who have been trying to, you know, blow the whistle and get people concerned about the outbreak of this very, very serious and scary potential pandemic. The most important example of this is a doctor named Li Wenliang, who is in Wuhan. Dr. Li had tried early on to try to draw attention to this outbreak and the seriousness of the measures that were necessary to deal with it. The Chinese government arrested him, basically. They forced him to sign a quote-unquote confession saying he was spreading rumors and shut him down. Later, Li, who was on the front lines of dealing with this, died of coronavirus, right? And this has become a massive problem. Even in information-constrained China, Li has become a symbol of the outbreak and of public anger. And we're going to get into that a little bit more. But the doctor's situation, I think, Alex, illustrates the way the Chinese government has handled the situation early on, right?
No, absolutely. And so first, just on Li, I mean, there's been an outcry from the public, as you alluded to. I mean, on Weibo, which is kind of a version of an important social media app for China. I mean, there's just been an outpour of support for him. He's almost seen as a martyr or this hero, as you mentioned. And people are just writing lovely messages about him and kind of using his face as a symbol of what's going on. And what's going on is, you know, as you said, there's a chance that the Chinese knew about this even as early as October. They didn't really come forward until December. They were shutting people up, likely, for so long. And this is why I did not appreciate the early takes about all this, which were, thank goodness this is happening in an authoritarian country, right? They are surveilling people and they can quarantine cities and just throw the entire force of the state behind this problem. The opposite has proven to be true. The fact that China is an authoritarian regime, that it has suppressed free speech, that it has suppressed a bunch of people, is precisely why we're in this mess. With if I have the numbers correct, you know, about 15,000 new cases confirmed in Hubei just on Thursday, and we have about 60,000.
Wait, really? This is like when we're recording Thursday. There's been 15,000 new cases.
Yeah,
that's extraordinary.
This is from Forbes, and we'll link to it in the show notes. But nearly 15,000 new cases were confirmed in Hubei on Thursday, mostly in the capital, Wuhan. This brings the number of confirmed infections to around 60,000. Okay?
Jeez.
So that's just – it's an insane issue here.
And we don't even know if those numbers are reliable, incidentally, right?
Because
they're
the
Chinese
problem.
Government numbers.
Exactly. So this is the problem, right, is that the suppression of free speech and the suppression of just information, just transparency in general – has made it extremely hard for not only the Chinese to combat this, to get the information out, and to help the world respond to this, right? In these kinds of health crises, it is vital, absolutely vital, that wherever the infection is, the country that is, you know, suffering it, that they do whatever they can to figure it out, obviously help their population, but then provide information to the rest of the world on what this thing is and when it started and how it transmits, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they just didn't really do that until extremely, extremely late. And this is part of the problem of why we're just seeing this, what seems like kind of an explosion of infections at the moment.
Right. I think this speaks to two points that are important to understanding how this has gone so wrong, the coronavirus response, right? The first is that just rounding up a bunch of people and putting them in places is not – like, that's not the correct public health response in these circumstances.
Quarantining 50 million people is not good?
Yeah, well, I mean, setting aside the ethics of it, right?
Right.
It's just not in and of itself the most effective way to prevent the disease from rapidly spreading. There are other public health things and tactics that one can use that are not just, like, locking huge numbers of people up. Of course, the ethics is the important part,
yeah.
I think, also, is that you cannot impose a police state or should not impose a police state on massive numbers of people, but you also should not have a police state in your entire country. So, from
chicken
my perspective.
And egg.
Yeah. But yeah. Second, I think also is that it illustrates this common misperception, I think, among a lot of people, or at least a sort of unreflective thought about China, which is that the people there swallow the government's line on things and believe what they're told when it comes from official state media. And that is not the case, right? Chinese people, I don't want to generalize for a country of over a billion people, but there are many people in China who consume official government propaganda skeptically. They understand that they're getting a filtered version of the truth. The situation is less that they, you know, believe what the government is saying, that they know that they don't know what's actually going on. They don't have access to other independent sources of information and just sort of generally don't have a good sense of what's happening and live in this twilight zone where they don't trust official government numbers and also don't have a good sense of what's happening. That's also true for a lot of people in democracies in a different way. But the point here is that they get this information from the government about what to do in the context of an epidemic, you know, sorts of behaviors, acceptable actions, and so on and so forth. And they don't believe it necessarily, right? And when you have a breakdown in public trust when it comes to a response to a pandemic, and there's like a systemic breakdown in public trust in China, right, because of the nature of the government, then you don't have people responding in the way that they should or ought to or in accordance with the best possible practices. So in that sense, the very nature of the government, which according to some like authoritarian sympathetic Western observers were like, well, this should promote a very efficient response, right? It's quite the opposite because of the informational problems inherent to China's authoritarian model.
Exactly. So let me give kind of an example, right? So December 31st of last year was the first time that China announced the outbreak. And, you know, it's a mysterious pneumonia. And, you know, basically what they said was that most of the patients had been to a food market in Wuhan, which again has been the epicenter of the outbreak. And what they said was there was no clear evidence of human-to-human transmission, right? So meaning that the virus wasn't really spreading from one person to another, but instead from animals to humans. And then they said that the earliest case that where they had where someone had shown symptoms was on December 12th. Well, that already – so like there's tons of things wrong with that already, right? First of all, we know already from literature and et cetera that it wasn't – that it was earlier than December. We know that there's human-to-human transmissions now. And then they just kind of went along with this line. Now, I do want to give the Chinese a slight credit here in that, you know, after the SARS epidemic or response, like the Chinese realized, and as did a lot of the world health infrastructure, they realized that the international community is just not ready to respond to pandemics. And we're still not. And it's something I'm genuinely frightened of. And we can talk about later on if you'd like. But they still have, as we mentioned, this transparency issue, and they still have bureaucratic problems with just reporting. So there is kind of a rigid bureaucratic system. There is this online reporting system. Like if you find, you know, if someone finds that there's a disease, you report up basically through your channels, and it goes from like local to city to state, and it kind of goes up there, and it's and if someone up above doesn't really want to look like they've mismanaged something, they can kind of shut it down. And this is part of the problem here. So it's just it's a nightmare from the beginning.
I think that's a really important point, actually, Alex, and I want to focus on it, right?
Sure.
This issue of the bureaucratic layers. Because I think it points to another reason why the Chinese response to this has been so ineffective.
Sure.
In some ways, right? So one characteristic of Xi Jinping's rule in particular has been increasingly centralized and personalized control under his authority. So while there's again, a perception that China is this kind of authoritarian technocracy where the best people pass meritocratic exams and move on, and while there's not freedom, at least there's smart, high-level management of public problems. In fact, that's never fully been the case. There have often – there's politics internal to the Chinese Communist Party that have led to, you know, really serious informational problems like misreporting of GDP in provinces to make yourself look better so no one's really sure how good China's economy actually is. But it's gotten worse under Xi because the incentive structure has shifted to being less independent, smart, you know, you contribute to the good of the party kind of meritocracy, and more, are you in with Xi? Are you loyal to the new way of doing things that has moved away from a collective party-based rule to an individualized dictatorial rule? And so as a result, you have people all different layers of the Chinese government who are not the competent technocrats that you need if you're trying to manage a kind of centralized response to a pandemic like this. And so Xi, I think, is personally discovering the limits of his attempt to create a one-man state in China.
And I want to give a bit of an example of this. So, you know, the local government in Wuhan, what they said originally was, oh, we were misinformed by the central, you know, their version of the CDC, Center for Disease Control. We were misinformed by the central CDC of China, whatever it may be, about the seriousness of the outbreak. And then the central CDC then goes, well, we didn't really have the authority to confirm these cases and, like, tell people. And this led to a bit of an issue in early January. So in early January, January 5th, actually, Wuhan stopped providing reports. And there was a break until they started doing so again on January 11th about what was going on. And the reason is that during those dates, the City People's Congress meeting was happening, as well as the political consultative as well as the political consultative conference. And these are very important meetings to appoint new leaders, make personnel changes at the local level. So this speaks to your point, Zach, which is at a moment when some, you know, technocrats and loyalists are sort of jockeying for position, trying to gain a bit more influence in Xi's personalized system. Even in a crisis like this, they just kind of like, all right, we're going to stop, right? Let's shut down the information. Let's give us a moment to maybe not look as bad. So we might be able to rise in the ranks. This is at least one theory of the case. And then once that's all done, now we can start to promote outward. Now we can start once again really kind of working on this issue. And so, yeah, I mean, Xi has found limits to the point that initially – he didn't even, like, try to become the face of the Chinese response. He had initially handed over some control, at least in the public relations part of it, to another top official. Now, I think because the response is getting a bit nuts, they've been calling for his leadership, and he is showing up wearing the mask and everything and meeting certain folks. But I think he has to know how treacherous this is for him, and it's a pretty tricky situation.
The last issue I want to talk about when it comes to sort of personalized rule before we go to a break is the way in which that this has shifted the structure of blame for this failed response to the crisis, right? In a world where, again, it's not the party, it's one guy who's in charge, right? There's no way for Xi to avoid being the public face of the government's response here. Like, he's tried, as you said, he's retreated from the spotlight and then started showing up recently. But in a world where everyone in China who's paying attention knows that you're the guy, not anyone in the party, it's very difficult to shift blame.
You're right? The leader for life, man.
Yeah, exactly. You made himself leader for life.
Yeah, you wanted to be leader for life. You had them adopt Xi Jinping thought. You took off the barriers to presidential rule. So you could be there until you die. Like, now you can't shirk a responsibility like this. This is what you signed up for.
So as a result, just yesterday, the head of Wuhan was fired from the Chinese government, which is a rare response, right? You don't get provincial leaders fired under circumstances like this very often, and it indicates a real anger at the way that this has been handled by the government and the popular will in China alike. Except this doesn't do all that much to shift the blame from Xi. I mean, it's something, but again, it's his system. It's his blame. Offloading that kind of responsibility to somebody else when you've constructed modern China around yourself, very difficult, it seems to me.
There's been a lot of talk about, you know, what kind of challenge this is going to provide to the Chinese system, seeing this lack of good response. And I got to be honest, I'm sensing from you, Zach, that you're worried about the state of this affair, or at least, you know, this kind of system. But I think this kind of personalist rule is going to last for quite some time in China, and I might want to debate you on it.
I don't know what I think. I genuinely don't know, and I can see arguments on both sides, and I think we're going to tackle them after the break, right? Get into more of the politics of the coronavirus beyond the failed response, not just why this failure happened, but what it means for China in the long run.
Support for this podcast comes from Smartwater. Life moves pretty fast. Are you drinking water that can keep up? Smartwater Alkaline has everything you need to stay hydrated, no matter where your day takes you. Whether you're pitching a tent or your next big idea, Smartwater Alkaline can help you perform your best. It delivers a pure, crisp taste that makes it the perfect chaser after a big workout. Elevate how you hydrate and pick up a Smartwater Alkaline today. To learn more, visit drinksmartwater.com.
Listen, I'm 24 and I still live at home. Like, what? For sure. Are you kidding me? My man and I, we attempted to move out.
Yeah, that'll be $1,600 for a studio apartment, not including groceries.
Last fall, the National Association of Realtors released data showing that housing affordability had fallen to its lowest point since the 1980s for reasons of economy, American.
There just aren't a lot of home sales going on. And there's really kind of a standoff right now between buyers and sellers.
That standoff leads to another kind of standoff.
It's always fun being 40-something years old and having to live with your parents again. And I know it's all my fault.
Sir, I don't know your life, but on Today Explained, a two-part series on how it might not be your fault. Our housing reality bites and the American dream is in your childhood bedroom. Series sponsored by Mint Mobile. Today Explained, in your feed every weekday.
And I'll tell my mom, "Mom, I'm going to the bathroom, I'll be back. If I'm not out in like 3 minutes, dog, She's like knocking on the door, going, "Everything okay in there?" "Yeah, Mom, everything's cool, dog."
All right, welcome back, worldly listeners. We are talking about the Chinese government's response to the coronavirus epidemic. And we started by talking about the reasons why the Chinese government's response has been so bad and so ineffective, and why it's galvanized such public anger. But now we want to talk a little bit about what the implications of mass discontent with the Chinese government's actions have been. And so to start off, I want to play a clip. This is Bill Bishop, a well-respected China analyst, talking on CNBC about what he thinks the significance of this situation might be for the state of the Chinese government. So let's listen to Bill for about a minute.
I think from the perspective of the Chinese leadership, this is really the biggest crisis they've faced in many years, perhaps since 1989, because they're looking at, as Derek said, I think this is a short-term economic hit, but they're looking at a significant economic hit of unknown duration. I think it'll be more than just this quarter. They're also looking at a massive human tragedy, which is affecting tens of millions of people right now, again, with no sign of it abating anytime in the next several weeks or a couple of months. And then third, you know, they're looking at, I think, a real potential failure of what we call performance legitimacy, where, you know, they just spent the last year talking about the superiority of the socialist system, and now they're in a situation where, you know, a province of tens of millions of people is effectively shut down and people are starting, you know, food is still in good supply, but you're seeing, you know, a pretty significant stressing and failure in some areas of the medical system.
So there's a lot I want to talk about in what Bill just said. For starters, biggest challenge to Chinese legitimacy since 1989. That's a huge statement, right? 1989,
massive.
Right, was the Tiananmen Square uprising that nearly toppled the Communist Party's rule. So when someone like Bill says that, I take it seriously. There's been a lot of loose talk about this floating around, but it's a real concern. But let's unpack bit by bit what he said, right? First, let's talk about the economic side of this, right? Alex, why is the response to the coronavirus so damaging to China's economy writ large?
So, I mean, we can speak to this on grand terms. Most of it is that if obviously, you know, if a bunch of people are sick and there's going to be a long-term response, the markets are not necessarily going to believe in the confidence, are not going to have confidence in China's economy going forward. A bunch of foreign countries may not want to invest or send their businesses there, and that could lead to a longer-term hit. On top of that, of course, you have fewer people going out to shop. You have fewer people, you know, actually just participating in the economy, and so there could be greater slowdowns. And this is already happening at a time when China's economy is still doing quite well, but does not have the boom times of old because it went from an extremely, extremely poor country to a nation with a very thriving middle class. And so it is the legitimacy for the Chinese government is that this economy continues to boom and that it continues to do at least very well, or at least have pretty solid numbers. And if there's a slowdown after coronavirus or during because of what we're seeing, then that causes greater problems for the government itself in Beijing and the Chinese Communist Party, because then not only will they be suffering an issue of health, but also a declining economy, and that just does not do well. I mean, imagine the United States, right? Here, our elections or whatever it may be, the government's success is usually pretty closely tied to economic performance. And so if the Chinese economic performance fails, then confidence in the Chinese government, not only within China, but around the world, fails too.
And there are also a lot of the specific measures are contributing to what is certain, by the way, certain to be some kind of economic slowdown in the first quarter in 2020. The question is how long and how bad it is, right? So for instance, China extended the Lunar New Year holiday so people wouldn't have to go to work or places where they could generally distribute a disease relatively effectively, like serve as vectors for infection. But when people are not going to work, they are not producing things. That's like a very specific and concrete vector by which an economic slowdown happens, and people will feel the results in the way that you were just talking about, right? This isn't just like abstract GDP numbers. It's people feel like they're poorer and they feel like something bad is happening to them, and it seems likely that they would blame the government in part because it's so clear that this is, even in a world of a very effective repression of the internet, it's been impossible to contain a public sense in China that this is the government's fault.
Sure, of course. If you're a shop owner, right, and no one's coming into your store at the moment because they're afraid of contracting they're afraid of contracting.
Yeah, it's not like a different way of memorizing.
No.
It is, in fact, a pneumonia.
It is a pneumonia, yes. Good morning to me. you know, if you're afraid of contracting this pneumonia, then, you know, this virus, then, of course, you're not going to go shop. It isn't – I'm going to mention an aside, but I think it's an important one. I was in Japan over a year ago now, and then I met with some Chinese scholars who are in Japan about kind of Japan-China relations. And the thing that stuck out with me, and I wrote a piece about it, which we can link to, was one of these scholars said that he's friends with an economist in China who did not want to name names. But this economist in China believed pretty intently that the real economic growth in China was like 0%, that the Chinese Communist Party is actually completely lying about its economic success, that it's all fabricated, that – and this is a well-respected scholar as well as the person
– Not just some random crank.
Yeah, exactly. This is real. And to me, just – again, it's an aside, but I think it's important – is I'm a bit more frightened of China's collapse and China's rise because a country of, what, 1.5 billion? I mean, a seventh of humanity effectively becoming a failed state would just be a massive humanitarian crisis and global catastrophe and economic disaster that one could imagine, really, and perhaps in years if not ever. So I think that's – we're very, 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 very far away from coronavirus even leading to that kind of future, to, you know, showing that the emperor has no clothes, that that this is really a Potemkin government, et cetera, et cetera. But – like that possibility, as minute as it is, exists.
I think it's important to focus on this opacity surrounding
sure.
whether or not China's actually been performing as it claims it has. Because it's arguable that while economic performance, like actual real performance, does matter in the way that we were just talking about a few minutes ago, it seems to me that the symbol or the perception of Chinese competence is much more important here, right? And so my thinking on this is informed by Alex Wang, who's a scholar at UCLA Law School and an expert on the Chinese legal system. And he wrote an article called Symbolic Legitimacy and Chinese Environmental Reform. The argument that he makes is that and I'll read this from the abstract. The entire project of governance reform can be structured in a way that influences public perceptions of state legitimacy. The process of reform is not only about attaining performance goals, but is itself a kind of performance. This act of performing performance also signals competence, commitment to the people, tradition, nationalist strength, and a host of other positive values to citizens and other audiences. This focus on the reform process itself as a means of symbolic legitimation, his term, is an example of China's authoritarian resilience that existing scholarship has virtually ignored. And I found this really insightful when I was thinking about the response to coronavirus, because it may or may not be the case that China is delivering on its promises to its citizens. But it does seem to me to be really important that some percentage, a significant percentage of people actually believe that they're not willing to engage in acts of resistance against the government. I'm not saying everyone's going to take to the streets. I mean, lower level protest stuff that sometimes builds into a broader popular challenge to the Chinese government. And there's this sense of competence. Right. And this, I think, like the thing about coronavirus that should really, really worry the Chinese government is that the symbolic legitimacy, on Wang's terms, is under attack. Right. And it's all their own fault.
Sure.
Right. And that's why the case of Dr. Li Wenliang is so important. It illustrates just how badly the government has failed here and how many cracks are emerging in the facade of symbolic legitimation.
Actually, when you read that, I had in my head the opening ceremonies of the Beijing Olympics.
Why is that?
Because, well, you remember, it was like hundreds of people banging the drums, and it was this incredibly impressive moment, and like these fireworks that looked like this giant was walking across the city. And I remember that there was a shift, at least in the U.S., about like, wait, China has arrived. Like, that was its moment, that it meant so much. South Park did an entire episode on just like, the Chinese are coming. Like, that was it. It changed a lot of feeling here that it wasn't this developing country that would eventually be powerful. No, it is powerful now. And for China at the time, that was an incredibly important thing for them to put on, because it showed, you know, precision and control and confidence And it was supposed, and it showed not only that China had arrived, but the Chinese government put on a great Olympics. And if I recall, those Olympics were actually quite good. So the symbolism of that, right, was like, we've got this. We're here. We're ready to go. Now, when faced with this massive challenge, modern-day China, Xi's China, seems to be struggling. And it doesn't have that same kind of control and precision and confidence with which it organized and like, portrayed itself on the world stage.
And so this leads us to the big question of to what extent we can speak about the immediate risk of, I don't know about regime collapse in failed states.
Yeah, I don't, you're just talking about. Yeah, I know that was way out there, but that's sort of where my head went.
But James Polymer, a China expert that we've had on the show before, tweeted yesterday, that is Wednesday, the 12th, that he's, quote unquote, mentally upping my odds of an attempted coup against Xi at some point during the coronavirus to, oh, let's say 15%, right?
Like, that's high.
Yeah. Like, he's sort of kidding around, right? It's like, sure, a semi-serious thing. But the fact that you have people speculating about a potential military coup against Xi Jinping, and even though it's like objectively low odds, it's still way higher than anybody would have said at any other point in Xi Jinping's reign.
Higher than zero. Yeah,
it's like, and to me, that, again, that underscores how serious this kind of problem is, specifically this kind of problem, because it affects all different sectors of Chinese power and significance, right? Like, it affects not only this symbolic legitimation, the sense of competence, it affects real economic performance by shutting down factories, offices, schools, etc. It affects China's perception internationally. Like, yeah, you're seeing a real, not only like really alarming xenophobia in certain places about Chinese nationals or even people of Chinese descent in Western countries. You've seen this both in the United States and England in a few cases, but also, you know, real restrictions on travel to and from China in order to prevent the spread of the outbreak, and a sense internationally that maybe if you're a business, let's say, you shouldn't rely so heavily on production inside China because the government is not capable of dealing with this kind of outbreak, right? And this is at a time when, as Bill said, China has been working really, 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 really hard at trying to show how great and effective its socialist system is, quote-unquote socialist, as compared to, you know, the omni-shambles going on in, say, the United States and Britain. And it seems like they've been able to make a relatively compelling case to a lot of people. But now this is a huge, huge, huge hit to that argument internationally.
And it's actually a boon, believe it or not, to the Trump administration's trade goals, because they've been trying to break the supply chains that China is so central to. It's been trying to convince countries to not really work that closely with China or to build their factories elsewhere in order to hurt the Chinese economy, to therefore put pressure on it so the U.S. could make better trade deals. And like now, if you see this kind of crisis, you see that if, you know, when things go badly, China has trouble handling it, you might actually start to think maybe the Trump administration has a point here. Maybe we should go to Vietnam. Maybe we should go to South Korea. Maybe we should go elsewhere in the region. And this, I mean, the ramifications of this, it's already really bad, right? 60,000 cases is already a tragedy. Let's make that clear. But as we were discussing before the show, like, I just have the sinking feeling that it's only going to get worse before it gets better, which means that all the things that we're talking about now will only be more felt and considered as we go along. Like, every second that ticks that the Chinese are not handling this as well as they could be is just a disaster for not only the government, but of course for the people and its prestige and its future.
It's also not the only one, right? Like, this is – we've had the past – how long have the Hong Kong protests been going on now at this point?
Year plus.
Yeah, right, which has been itself a kind of real challenge to China's international perception and to a degree its domestic legitimacy, though there's obviously been intense censorship domestically. So I don't know. I don't feel comfortable saying this is – the most serious crisis for China since 1989, in part because people have said that repeatedly since then, right? Like every few years, it seems like, and there's been a number of examples of this flying around on Twitter, of people saying, oh, this is the biggest crisis for China. You know, there's a train crash, biggest crisis. Floods in Beijing, biggest crisis, right? Et cetera. That kind of thing keeps getting bandied about. At the same time, though, when you delve into the details of coronavirus, as we've been doing on the show, and you pile more and more pieces of evidence, it seems to me that this is exactly the kind of thing that could theoretically trigger mass discontent with the Chinese government, especially if there are knock-on effects. China's You know, its financial markets aren't necessarily as stable as a lot of people think they are. In fact, they're arguably quite unstable. And so you can see dominoes starting to fall in a way that would be very, very dangerous for the regime. Again, I'm not predicting that. No more confident than James is on his like 15% of a coup attempt, not even a coup, when it comes to mass protests. I'll go lower than that, like significantly. I'm just saying that the odds went from very, very, very unlikely to significantly less unlikely.
To one less very.
maybe even two.
Yeah.
It'd be crazy.
So I'll expand on what I teased before we broke for ads. I'm actually pretty confident. Well, as are you, I guess. They're going to muddle through this. For years, I'm no expert as Bill Bishop is on China, but I do know that for years there are just like hundreds to thousands of protests in China a day.
That's true.
Against the government or the local government, whatever it may be.
They're not like against the centralized government.
Right.
They're like pro-democracy protests. Yeah. That's like environmental protests, concerns about, you know, pollution. Air pollution, specifically, stuff like that.
Yeah, exactly. And it's allowed somewhat on purpose to, you know, just release a steam valve just a little bit, just enough, so people feel like they get their anger out. And obviously, coronavirus is a bigger challenge than these kinds of things. But there is already a decent discontent, as we've talked about, with the way the government is operated, with the way things are going. And yet, I mean, the Communist Party is just so entrenched, so deep inside the country, it has so much control that I just have trouble believing it's going to fall, or that, you know, she won't be able to last this whole time. Like, I'm pretty confident that's still the outcome. He may be weakened as a leader and the perceptions of him weakened on the global stage and within the country, but like the system survives. Maybe what I hope is that if another situation like this happens again in China, that they will have learned their lessons and have improved. Again, they improved after SARS. Hopefully after this, they improve again. But Xi survives, the government survives, I think, but they muddle through. And it's, I guess, a testament to just the years of how the Communist Party in China has actually ingrained itself within the country.
Did they improve after SARS, though? This was a 2005 outbreak, and you saw a lot of the same problems in their handling 15 years later that you saw then.
But the reporting was better, the response. More experts than – there have been experts that have said that at least they have improved their procedures after SARS. Whether or not they really performed is a separate issue, but they at least learned some lessons, set up some sort of practices, and did employ them, although albeit late and after transparency issues.
But I guess that's what gives me a little bit more – I don't want to say like optimism, but – hope that this is a real shock to the system in China, right? Because the flaws are inherent to the Chinese government model. They can improve technically on certain aspects of it, but still you have the same lack of transparency. You have the same self-interested actors in the government who care more about their own status and of covering up things that look bad for them than they care about, public health in general. And arguably, that's gotten worse since Xi Jinping's quote-unquote anti-corruption purge has gotten rid of a bunch of people who he just didn't like and reinstalled cronies or installed cronies to replace them, right? Like, there are lots of reasons to think that this system is inherently prone to these kinds of crises, right? And if the Chinese public can learn from the horrible way that their government has mishandled this crisis, and frankly – it's gotten a lot of people killed, and who knows where else this could go and what other parts of the Chinese project this could contaminate. I'm thinking, and what really scares me, is that this gets into the really crowded, horrible concentration camps that they've set up for Muslims in Xinjiang, right, as part of this ongoing cultural cleansing process, which is, you know, one of the most horrific crimes against humanity in the world that we've talked about on the show before, in fact, with James Palmer. But doesn't get nearly enough attention, right? When you concentrate people like that in camps, a disease breaking out there is horrifying. And we don't know. We have no idea.
Again, that's the
if it's
problem.
Gotten there.
Yeah. At a minimum, the Chinese owe it to the people who are sick, who are infected, to the families of those who are sick, to those who have died, to get to the bottom of this, solve it. And frankly, also to the rest of us, because We're nowhere near us here in the studio, us in the United States. We're nowhere near as close to the at risk as those in China, but we're at risk. And so they got to get on this. And if not just for global health and political reasons, but just for moral reasons, it's their fault.
Yeah, this is where I put on my moralizer hat, right? Authoritarian governance isn't just, you know, bad in sort of an outcome-oriented, you know, they don't produce growth as well as democracies do. Authoritarian governments, by their nature, abuse human rights. By their nature, view their people as disposable. That is what they do. And it is on display vividly in the Chinese response to this. And it shows to me that this regime should be regarded not just as a global rival to the United States, not just as a country that you have to make deals with to prevent catastrophic war or economic outcomes, but as a moral blight, as a government that is hurting its own people most of all, despite some productive economic gains. And that if we don't talk about and think about the evils of the Chinese government, in addition to the practical realities of having to live with it, and keep those two thoughts in our head at the same time, I don't think we will have a full and morally justifiable understanding of the challenge of dealing with the CCP as we go forward.
Well said.
All right. Now that I've ranted at all of you and gotten my feelings out, as I've gotten very angry reading the coverage of the coronavirus situation and how this has affected so many people inside China, I will thank the people who have helped us produce the show where I've gotten to rant, specifically our engineer, Malachi Brodus, our producer, Jackson Bierfeldt. And I want to encourage all of you to rate, subscribe, and review Worldly wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks a lot and see you all next week.
Feel better, Jen.
Support for this podcast comes from Smartwater. Want to get a little more from every sip? Smartwater Alkaline doesn't just taste crisp and pure. It's loaded with everything you need to perform at your best, whether you're running marathons or boardroom meetings. Elevate how you hydrate and pick up a Smartwater Alkaline today. To learn more, visit drinksmartwater.com.